Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy. I'm Chris North, and what you're about to listen to was originally broadcast as part of Pythagoras' Trousers, a science and engineering show on Radio Cardiff. You can find a full show and listen to past episodes at pythagorastrousers.co.uk. But for now, here's this month's astronomy. In March 2015, there'll be a remarkable event visible from the UK, a partial eclipse of the sun. If you go to much more northerly latitudes, you might see a total eclipse of the sun, but from the UK, we'll be restricted to a partial eclipse. In an eclipse of the sun, the moon passes between the Earth and the sun, and from our point of view, appears to block part of it out. Now, it might seem odd that it doesn't do this every single month. After all, the moon goes around the Earth once every 28 days or thereabouts, so one might expect it to pass in front of the sun once every month, but it doesn't. To explain all these things about partial eclipses and what's going on here, I'm joined by Edward Gomez. So welcome to the programme, Edward.
Hi, Chris.
So why doesn't the moon cause a solar eclipse every month?
Well, it's tempting to think about the solar system as being like one of those clockwork orreries that you see, where everything is on discs and they rotate evenly, and the Earth going around the sun and the moon going around the Earth. But actually, there are very subtle differences in the alignment of all of the planets, and the Earth is no exception in this.
And the moon's orbit is tilted at about 5 degrees to the Earth's orbit around the sun, so that's one of the things that means it normally passes too high or too low.
When it comes to eclipses, the alignment is very, very important, because the moon only sometimes totally will fit over the disk of the sun when you view it from the Earth. If the moon's too far from the Earth, then you get an effect where the sun isn't totally covered by the moon, and you get a ring around. Total solar eclipses happen very, very rarely, and it's the alignment of all these, the three bodies, the sun, the Earth and the moon, that's very, very important.
And on the 20th of March next month, the alignment will be such that the moon will pass directly in front of the sun, and we will see it cut off from Cardiff about 90% of the sun's light. And it's going to be quite a sight to see it, I thought.
Yeah, it really will. You've got to be really careful when you view any type of eclipse. Well, any type of solar eclipse. You're pretty safe when you're viewing lunar eclipses. But if you're viewing a solar eclipse, it's very tempting to look directly at the eclipse sun, because the light is so much dimmer than it normally is. But actually, the rays are still as harmful, and your reflexes just won't, you know, make you turn away or whatever. So make sure, if you are going to look at the sun, even in a partial eclipse, that you use eclipse glasses or welder's goggles or something that's going to block out, you know, 99.999% of the light.
And you can buy solar eclipse glasses online. They're normally called eclipse glasses. Lots of retailers would sell them. They shouldn't be more than a few pounds at most. The sun can be very dangerous, so one should certainly never look through any optical device that's magnifying it, so binoculars or even a camera viewfinder, certainly not a telescope, without some sort of protection in place. And if you're doing that, you must make sure you know what you're doing. The safest way to view the sun is actually to project it.
Yeah, that's right. You just get a very, very simple pinhole camera and you project an image of the sun onto the ground, or you can buy apparatuses which sort of have a little shaded viewing area for the projection of the sun to be seen. And the projection of the sun is quite faint, so it does need to be like a pinhole camera or a camera obscura type thing where the image is in a sort of a shadier place. But this is a really good way of seeing the eclipse, because you can see sunspots, you can see all sorts of detail on the surface of the sun, and you can make it bigger so a lot of people can look at it at the same time.
So if you get a cardboard cube that you've made out of cereal boxes or something.
Shoebox would be great, yeah.
One side of it you replace entirely with a piece of tracing paper, something like that, and then on the opposite side of that you put this little pinhole, you should be able to project the sun. And the best thing about the sun is, of course, if you have a nice sunny day in advance of the solar eclipse, you can go and practice and try it out. On the day of the eclipse from Cardiff, the sun will be blocked out about 90% by the moon, or thereabouts. It depends on exactly where in the UK you are. Edward, are you going to be in the UK for the event?
No, I'm not. I'm going to be in Iceland, which is not quite on what we call the path of totality. So there's a strip across the globe where there's 100% of the light from the sun is blocked. And unfortunately, that mostly occurs over the North Atlantic Ocean. It does actually hit land across the Faroe Islands, and just off the eastern coast of Iceland. I'll be in Reykjavik, which is on the western coast. So where I am, it'll probably be about 98%, so a bit better than Cardiff, but still not total.
The timing is also very important. These eclipses don't take very long to happen. They're a matter of a couple of hours. And so in the UK, about 9:30 in the morning is going to be when the peak is, and it'll be about an hour either side of that that you'll be able to see something. Now, solar eclipses have been used in the past to test a lot of things. It's the only way you can easily view something called the sun's corona. So while with a partial eclipse, you won't see what's called the corona, with people on the path of totality who do see the sun completely blocked out will see this. And this is the faint diffuse material flowing off the sun.
Yeah, that's right. It's strange to think that the sun has an atmosphere, but it does, although the gas at the edge of the sun, the sort of surface of the sun, is a lot cooler than the interior. It's still incredibly hot.
So the surface of the sun is about 6,000 degrees in temperature, which is pretty hot. The very core is tens of millions of degrees, so much hotter, where the nuclear fusion happens that powers the sun. The corona of the sun, this atmosphere, which you see stretching away as these particles move along the magnetic field lines of the sun, so you get remarkable views. The corona is actually much, much hotter than the surface of the sun. It's something we don't fully understand.
Yeah, that's right. The corona can be as hot as millions of degrees, and we really don't understand. It's possibly something to do with the fact that the gas is so rarefied, so it goes into a strange plasma state and is superheated again, like you said, but with some magnetic effect of the magnetic field.
The sun's magnetic field is something that's very important. It controls not only, we think, this or plays an important role in the heating of the corona, but also things called sunspots, these black marks of the sun. The magnetic field is critical to those.
Yeah, that's right. And sunspots, they look like little black dots on the surface of the sun. They also look very small, but sunspots are actually incredibly large. If you were to overlay the Earth on top of the surface of the sun, sunspots are probably about the size of the Earth. So they are these enormous regions that are... they look black because they're cooler than the surrounding material, the surrounding stuff that's on the surface of the sun. But they're not incredibly cooler. They're a few hundreds of degrees cooler. So it's not like they're at room temperature and the rest of the solar surface is at 6,000 degrees.
So lots of things we still don't really understand about the sun. In fact, one thing that wasn't to do with the sun, but a solar eclipse did help prove. At the start of the 20th century, a solar eclipse was very useful for helping prove one of Einstein's theories of relativity. So Einstein's general theory of relativity. And this is about how light bends around massive objects. So what was going on there?
Yeah, that's it's a centenary. So it was 1915 that paper was published, postulating that gravity had a weird effect on the universe. So anything that has mass potentially produces a gravitational field. Me, Chris, the Earth, the Sun, everything with mass, the chair that I'm sitting on and the microphone I'm speaking into, all to varying degrees, and it's only dependent on the amount of mass that each of those things has. And what Einstein first postulated was that the amount of mass produces a curvature in the fabric of the universe, this quantity called space-time, which is a very strange concept that he came up with, merging both space and time, something that we can move in you know, two abstract different ways. And what was done, it was done by a physicist, a British physicist called Arthur Eddington, who followed the eclipse in 1919, and he wanted to see if there was this strange bending effect of the fabric of the universe, this space-time. And how that would present itself would be that the light from stars wouldn't follow a straight line, but because the sun has mass and it warps this quantity space-time, it would travel on a curved path and we'd be able to see the stars. Now, normally they'd be hidden from us by the sun anyway because the sun is so bright, but at an eclipse, the sun goes completely dark, allowing you to see these stars.
And the bending of light meant that taking photos at night time when the sun's not there, and then a photo of the sun with the eclipse going on, so you could see these background stars, and that difference albeit very, very tiny, so to not perceptible to the human eye at all. But in the analysis of the photo showed that, in fact, the deflections, the apparent motion of these stars, the apparent movement of these stars was bang on what Einstein had predicted in his paper.
Yeah, that's right. It was really an incredibly simple thing to do, and very, very powerful, because it proved this theory, which up until that point, lots of people didn't really believe.
So that was one of the big proofs of Einstein's theory of general relativity. And of course, this year is the International Year of Light, partially celebrating that publication of that theory in 1915. And there may be lots of events going on. Of course, the solar eclipse is just one of them. So there will be lots of celebrations around the world to do with the International Year of Light. Now we can move on to something else. So, Edward, you had a story from the place you worked, so Las Cumbres Observatory Global Telescope, and something that's been going on there.
That's right. So one of the things that we're interested in, because we have a network of telescopes, we can respond to things changing in the night sky very, very quickly. So we tend to look for supernovae, for extrasolar planets, and we look for things in our solar system. So asteroids, comets, and near-Earth objects. And a colleague of mine was observing a near-Earth object on the 17th of February, and it has the fantastic name of 2015 DD1, which these asteroids always have really boring names. And he made observations of this asteroid 12 hours after it was discovered. And the interesting thing about it is that the asteroid passed 40,000 kilometres away from the surface of the Earth. So that's probably about 8 times closer than the Moon is. Okay, that's a little bit worrying. But actually, we only found out about it after it had passed that closest point. So, you know, lucky it didn't hit us. Well, actually, not particularly, because the thing was only a few meters in diameter. So had it come towards Earth, it would have most likely exploded or broken up in the atmosphere. But still, it's a very small object that came quite close to us. And it's fantastic to get that sort of observation. It really does it really does put you in touch with, you know, why you want to do these type of observations really, really quickly.
And we need to understand how many of these asteroids there are out there. As you say, this one's a few metres across, not going to do any damage when it hits. It will burn up. But if there was something like this that was 10, 100 times bigger than that, then it would pose a serious threat.
Yeah, that's right. We probably would have noticed one that was 10 or 100 times bigger earlier. But still, we couldn't have done very much about it. So it is a continual effort to try and keep up with the number of asteroids that there are out there. The dynamics of asteroids are constantly changing because the solar system never sits still. There's always different gravitational pulls from Jupiter and the Sun, which pull asteroids out of the main belt of asteroids and pull them onto orbits that cross the Earth's orbit.
Well, from objects in our solar system, the Sun, and then a tiny asteroid, I want to move to a very different scale, both in distance and size, and indeed in time. In February 2015, the Planck satellite released a new batch of results, an update on previous images and data released about 2 years beforehand. These results contain clues as to the processes that took place in the first tiny fraction of the universe's existence, as well as the formation of stars from gas and dust within our own galaxy. To find out more about the mission and what its results are telling us, I spoke to Dr. Hiranya Peris from University College London, and I began by asking her to describe Planck and what it's told us so far.
So the main science goals of Planck is to map with a very high sensitivity and precision the earliest light that you can see in the universe, the so-called cosmic microwave background. So this is radiation from when the universe was about 400,000 years old. Now it's about 14 billion years old, so it's like a baby picture of the universe. And at that time, the radiation that was, you know, all throughout the universe was basically uniform everywhere except for tiny little wrinkles or variations. And we see that as little fluctuations in the light that is being mapped by Planck. So Planck has been surveying this light. The mission's actually now complete. And what we are doing now is to take this cornucopia of data that's been recovered from Planck and to analyze it, to try to learn about the properties of the very early universe, its contents, how it's evolving, and even things like when the first stars formed and how that affected the universe.
So Planck acts as almost a time machine. You're seeing stuff from the start of the universe as well as stuff that took place much more recently.
That's right. So this actually happens because the speed of light is finite. So it's a very high speed, but it is a finite speed. So that means that when you look into the distant universe, you're seeing things as it was back in the past. So when we look all the way back to this earliest light you can see, you're seeing a baby picture of the universe. But that light, as it propagates from that very early time to us, also has encounters with other structures that form in the late universe. So on top of this baby picture of the universe, you can get imprints of other signals which happen closer and closer to us, and therefore at more and more recent epochs. And by disentangling all of these effects, you can get a time-varying picture of the universe, which is very detailed, very precise, and contains a lot of information about a variety of things.
And to do this, Planck looks at nine different colours of light. So it looks at microwave light, so much longer wavelength than light we see. It looks at these nine different colours of light, and that lets us see, as you mentioned, so many different epochs in the universe's evolution, and we can disentangle what's been taking place. So apart from this baby picture of the Big Bang, this cosmic microwave background, what other things is Planck showing us?
So because Planck has these nine different colors that it can look at, it can also see the difference between the baby picture and microwave emissions from our own galaxy. So we live inside the plane of a galaxy, and we see its structures projected onto our sky, and they form sort of like a foreground that is in front of the baby picture. And the way that we can disentangle these effects is because as you go through these different colors, the baby picture kind of looks the same, but the colors that are given out by our own galaxy change. So by using those changing colors, we can actually separate that part out. And once we do that, we can, for example, get a very detailed picture of the magnetic field that is there entangled with the matter that's in our galaxy. And that's the first time we've been able to do that. And this light from the galaxy also actually carries a lot of information about something very important, which is almost like a contaminant to something that we're looking for in the very, very early moments of the universe. For example, we think that the process that took place in the very, very early first instance of the universe, the so-called inflation era, created gravitational waves. It essentially set all of space ringing like a bell, and this ringing is caused by primordial gravitational waves. Unfortunately, the signal of that gravitational wave light can actually be confused with something very mundane, which is the alignment of dust grains in the magnetic field of our own galaxy. So that very mundane close-in signal looks the same as this very fundamental ringing in the whole space of our universe. Planck can tell those things apart, and this can give us insight into what happened in the very, very early universe in a very accurate way that has not been possible before.
The astronomer's view of star formation in our galaxy from dense clumps of gas and dust is, to a cosmologist, is just contamination of all that pesky stuff in the foreground in many ways.
Yeah, it's all in the way. But when you then talk to astronomers that study the formation of dust in the galaxy. I mean, this is again a very amazing thing, isn't it? That, you know, all this what we call dust, it sounds very boring, but actually this is stardust. This is stuff that we are all made of in the end. This dust is manufactured in stars and in supernovae, very big explosions of massive stars. Planck can see that dust, and astronomers that study the formation of evolution of dust in the universe are super excited to see this contaminant that cosmologists don't like. So yeah, there's something for everybody.
The fluctuations in the early universe formed the first stars and galaxies and led to the structures we see around us today. But seeing those first galaxies and those first stars is something that's incredibly hard to do. Now, Planck doesn't see those structures directly, but it does see a signature of what's going on and those first when the universe first lit up from these objects. And Hiranya, how does Planck do that?
Okay, so when Planck looks at the light from the baby universe, it doesn't just see the lights, but it sees the different directions in which light vibrates. This is particularly interesting because when the very first stars turn on, they bathe the universe in ultraviolet light. And this light is so energetic that it dissociates the dominant element in the universe, hydrogen, into its constituents, protons and electrons. So this light has till then been propagating in a kind of transparent universe. And the moment that it encounters this sea of electrons, it becomes opaque to light. And then it starts scattering off these electrons. And it starts vibrating in a particular direction. The light actually acquires a handedness in a way. By looking for the signal of this handedness, we can tell when the first stars turned on in the universe. So Planck has found something quite interesting using this signal. So Planck is able to observe this handedness of the light, the different kind of vibration. And from that, it has worked out that the first stars turned on about 100 million years later than was previously thought. This might sound like a very long time in terms of human timescales, but maybe not such a long time in the sense of the age of the universe. And yet it's really important because the previous CMB satellite, the so-called WMAP satellite, had also made a measurement of this kind of vibration of light and had inferred that the first stars actually formed earlier. But because Planck observes in different colors, more colors than this previous experiment, it is able to subtract this foregrounds, this contaminants from our own galaxy better. And because of that, it has determined that, the earlier experiment didn't quite get the right answer. It was very slightly off. But being very slightly off was enough to make a very confusing situation when you then looked for the very earliest galaxies that you can see in the universe through telescopes. And the difference that you got from the first star's age, looking at the cosmic microwave background, was discrepant with what you inferred by studying the very first galaxies that you could see. And this sort of discrepancy is very annoying to cosmologists because, you know, we can't directly go and make an experiment and make a universe and say the first stars turn on at a certain time. We have to piece together the story almost like a detective or maybe a paleontologist trying to reconcile one set of evidence with another set of evidence. And Planck's finding that the first stars formed 100 million years later than previously thought actually agrees perfectly with what the people observing through telescopes like the Hubble and trying to find the very first galaxies, what they were finding. So now all of these different stories from very, very different types of information about the universe agree, and we have a much better idea of when the first stars turned on. And this later time for this age of the first stars is actually very good news for the next generation space telescope, the so-called James Webb Space Telescope, because Before, if WMAP's answer had been right, these space telescopes could have struggled to see the era of the first stars, but now there's quite a good chance that it can see it. And similarly, there are big radio telescopes being built on the ground, like the Square Kilometer Array and other smaller radio telescopes. And they are also looking for this signal from the very first stars. And again, now Planck's finding makes it more likely that they will be able to probe this very important era in the universe.
Well, you talked about these imprints from the early universe, and that's actually telling us about processes that took place in the first very, very tiny fraction of a second after the Big Bang. What do we currently understand about the first moments of the universe's existence?
So in the current understanding, the universe underwent a sort of growth spurt in a very tiny fraction of a second. It expanded by an enormous factor, a factor of 10 followed by another 28 zeros. So very, very large factor that it expanded by. And as it did that, there was quantum mechanical processes going on. In other words, the whole of space was kind of bubbling up in little fluctuations. And these quantum fluctuations got stretched out by the rapid expansion of the universe into all the stuff that we now see in the universe. It all originated as quantum fluctuations. So this is an amazing story, which sounds kind of like science fiction, but Planck has been able to test many of the predictions of this theory, which is called cosmic inflation. So it's not inflation as the economy is currently not doing, but it's the inflation of the whole universe. So, for example, the little fluctuations, the quantum fluctuations that this process of inflation creates, from which all the subsequent structure originated, if you think about it as listening to a piece of music, there are different frequencies in that music which correspond to different wavelengths of fluctuations. And the universe could be either slightly bass heavy or slightly treble heavy in this analogy. And one of the predictions of many models of inflation is that there should be either a bass heavy or treble heavy setup, but not, you know, the same amount of fluctuations at all the different frequencies. So what Planck has discovered is that the universe is slightly bass heavy, but very, very slightly. And this prediction that was confirmed by Planck actually lent credence to this very science fiction sounding theory. It's a very strong support. Another thing that this theory of inflation predicts is that the universe should have a very simple geometry, essentially the Euclidean geometry that you study in school, which of course is really great when you try to do then calculations as a cosmologist, because it really simplifies the maths. But, you know, it didn't need to have been that geometry. And Planck has confirmed this prediction to a sub-percent accuracy now, and that's really a prediction that has been confirmed. Another thing that Planck has done, and this is a slightly more difficult thing to explain, is that the light from the early universe, if you look at it in terms of little fluctuations, so they're little hot spots and little cold spots compared to the average temperature of the universe. And the statistics of those hot and cold spots are predicted by inflation to follow the statistical distribution of a bell curve, a so-called a normal distribution. And Planck has confirmed that prediction to about one part in 10,000. This is like the most accurate measurement we have at present in cosmology. So there are all these different ways in which we can test this model. And what Planck has done is to verify a large number of them. But there is this, this prediction that there should be primordial gravitational waves. And that's something that we have still not yet confirmed.
And this prediction of early gravitational waves has been the origin of a saga over the last year or so, or well, over the past 100 years, I guess. But over the last year or so, it's really come to the forefront of cosmology, with results published about a year ago that a team running a telescope down in Antarctica called BICEP-2 had possibly found indications or possibly found evidence of these gravitational waves from this inflationary period, this cosmic inflation period. And the evidence they had was not convincing enough for a lot of cosmologists. And in fact, the work with Planck has shown that it's actually probably not that convincing at all because of all these foreground effects.
That's completely right. So this BICEP telescope, of course, is actually a beautiful experiment. It worked extremely well. They reached the sensitivity to start to see a tiny, tiny signal of gravitational waves in the early universe. So, for example, it's more sensitive than Planck in some sense. But it only had one wavelength. So that means it didn't have these nine colors that Planck has, and that's what gives Planck the ability to tell the difference between dust in our own galaxy and primordial gravitational waves in the early universe. So because BICEP didn't have that capability, they could not tell that difference, and therefore the signal that they observed, which they interpreted as being mostly primordial gravitational waves, was actually probably quite contaminated by, dust from our own universe. Dust from our own galaxy. But combined with Planck analysis, now you can tell, using Planck's nine colors and BICEP's one color, what is the expected fraction of gravitational waves in the signal that BICEP observed. As you just said, it's unclear whether you can tell the difference just with the current data they have. Both the BICEP experiment and its successes, and also other ground-based experiments from balloons that are flying around in places like Antarctica, very cold places, are going after this signal, because it is a very... it's an amazing signal to discover, and therefore, there's a very competitive effort going forward around the world in order to be the first to discover this. And the way that Planck helps this effort at the moment is that it's got this eye in space with nine colors, and it can tell you whether any signal that you observe comes from our galaxy or is more likely to come from the very first instance of our own universe.
And I think that's an important point, that although there's a lot of energy expended on being the first to make these discoveries, that we only really get anywhere when these experiments work together, when we use all the information from these experiments together. So BICEP-2 plus Planck has shown us a lot more. And as you say, these upcoming experiments, SPIDER and Keck Array and all these things will help show us a lot more in the future. So it's going to be exciting times in terms of gravitational waves from inflation, I suppose.
It's going to be extremely exciting. I think that in the coming few years, we'll start to really beat down the frontier in this particular area. It's a new window in the universe, if these are discovered, of course. We do have this fun competitiveness in our field, and I think that's healthy because that drives people to make better and better experiments. But this is such a momentous discovery, were it to be claimed, that you would need corroboration among a whole set of experiments in order to say that this discovery has been made. It's a really good thing that so many different excellent teams are going after it.
Yes, it certainly is going to be an exciting few years for the cosmology community. Haranya Peris from University College London, thanks very much. And of course, don't forget, if you want to see that solar eclipse we talked about earlier, then the morning of the 20th of March, peaks about 9:30, we'll be out in front of the National Museum in Cardiff, trying to observe, weather permitting, of course. You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. It was originally broadcast on Radio Cardiff as part of Pythagoras' Trousers.